Alright, welcome back to Clowncast. I have a question for you.
Hit me.
Have you ever played Breath of the Wild?
Have I ever, Jude? I have like 400 hours in that game. Why?
So you know, the paraglider, the item you get early on, you jump off a tower, you pull it out, and you just float.
Best item in the game. Arguably the best item in any game ever made.
Right, and the thing that makes it work is you're always managing this invisible resource, stamina. You launch from somewhere high, and every second you're in the air, you're spending altitude. But if you catch an updraft, you get some back. You're constantly reading the terrain below you, looking for those columns of rising air, deciding when to glide and when to circle.
Yeah, and if you run out of stamina over a lake, you just splosh. Game over.
Exactly. So what if I told you that someone looked at that exact mechanic, launch from a high point, ride invisible air currents, manage your altitude like a resource, and said, I want to do that, with my actual body, off an actual mountain.
I would say the person is either a genius or needs therapy.
Three of them, actually. And they were broke.
Of course they were broke. Every great invention starts with someone who can't afford the normal version of something.
June 1978, Miessy, France. Three parachutists, Jean-Claude Badims, André Bonne, and Gerard Bussin. They love skydiving, right? But they can't afford airplane fuel. Like, literally cannot afford to get in a plane and jump out of it.
The most expensive hobby in the world, and they picked it while being poor. Relatable honesty.
So Badims reads this article about something called slope soaring, and he has this beautiful, stupid idea. He goes, what if we don't need the plane at all? What if we just take our square parachutes, run down a mountain slope, and let the wind inflate the canopy?
That's okay. That's either brilliant physics or a very elaborate suicide attempt.
He does the math first. They calculate that the slope angle plus wind speed plus the ram air canopy design should, theoretically, inflate the chute and generate enough lift to glide. So Badims launches from Point du Pertuiset and flies 100 meters.
100 meters? That's like half a football field.
It's not far, but it worked. He didn't die. And then Bone goes next and glides 1,000 meters down to an actual football pitch in the valley below.
Wait, 1,000 meters? That's a full kilometer on the second attempt ever.
Second attempt ever, and the French word for it, parapente, literally means paraslope, parachute plus slope. They invented the word the same day they invented the sport.
I love that. Three dudes too broke to skydive accidentally create a new category of human flight and name it before lunch.
But here's where it gets complicated. Because those three guys, they weren't actually first.
Oh no!
13 years earlier, 1965, a guy named David Barish, called a PhD, aeronautical engineer, he'd been working on something called the sailing. And get this, it was originally designed for NASA. The idea was to use flexible fabric wings to bring space capsules back to Earth instead of round parachutes.
So paragliding was supposed to be a space program technology.
Yeah, NASA even coined the word paraglider in the 60s for this capsule recovery concept. The sport literally stole its name from the space program.
That's incredible, and Barish actually flew one of these things.
September 1965. He makes the first intentional paraglider descent from a cliff in the Catskill Mountains, controlled flight with a fabric wing, launching from a slope. He then spends 1966 touring American ski resorts trying to pitch slope soaring as a summer activity to replace skiing in the off-season.
And?
Nobody cared.
No.
He dies in 2009, largely uncredited. The French trio gets the founding mythology. Barish gets a Wikipedia footnote and occasional articles calling him the forgotten father of paragliding.
That is genuinely tragic. The classic invention versus popularization problem.
It really is. But to be fair to the French guys, the tech wasn't really ready in 65. The thing that actually made paragliding possible, like actually controllable and safe enough to be a sport, was a different invention entirely. In 1964, a guy named Dominique Jalbert creates the ram air canopy.
Okay, what is that?
So imagine, a round parachute is basically an umbrella, right? It catches air and slows you down. That's it. You fall slower. A ram air canopy is completely different. It's a double layer of fabric with cells between them that inflate with oncoming air. When those cells fill up, the canopy takes the shape of an actual airfoil, like an airplane wing.
Wait, so it's not a parachute at all?
It's not. It's a true wing that generates lift. It has more in common with a 747's wing than with a round parachute. You're not falling slowly. You're flying. And this is where I want to bring in the real metaphor for understanding how this sport works.
I'm ready.
You ever watch Avatar, The Last Airbender?
Only about 14 times, yeah.
So airbenders don't create wind. This is the crucial thing people miss about that magic system. Aang doesn't generate air from nothing. He reads existing currents, feels where the air is moving, how it's flowing, and then redirects it. He joins the air. He becomes part of the pattern that's already there.
Right, it's less like a superpower and more like surfing. You're working with something that already exists.
That's exactly what paragliding is. You cannot make a thermal. You can only find one and use it. And experienced pilots read the invisible world the same way an airbender would. They look at the ground and see thermals that aren't there yet.
What do you mean not there yet?
Okay, so thermals. The sun heats the ground unevenly. Dark asphalt heats up faster than light grass, which heats faster than water. That warm ground heats the air above it. And eventually that pocket of warm air detaches from the surface and rises in an invisible column. When you're in a paraglider and you hit one of these, it's like stepping onto an elevator. You circle inside the rising column and you gain altitude, sometimes thousands of meters.
So the air is just invisibly shooting upward in columns all over the place.
All over the place. And experienced pilots read the landscape like a thermal map. They see a parking lot and think thermal trigger. A rocky south-facing slope. Thermal trigger. A freshly plowed field. Big thermal trigger. And the really beautiful tell. Cumulus clouds. Those puffy white clouds on a sunny day. Those are the visible caps of thermals. The cloud is literally the thermal's exhaust.
I'm never going to look at clouds the same way again. So they're basically reading a data layer that's invisible to everyone else.
This is where it really maps to airbending. In Avatar, Aang's progression isn't about getting more powerful. It's about getting more sensitive. He goes from this raw natural talent, throwing big gusts around, to this refined mastery where he can feel individual air currents, detect changes before they happen, move through the air instead of against it.
And that same progression exists in paragliding.
The data on this is wild. Pilots with fewer than 100 hours, they account for 62% of fatalities.
62%.
But pilots with 200 plus hours have 70% fewer accidents than the average. Experience is overwhelmingly the single biggest safety factor. Not equipment, not weather. Experience. Your ability to read what the air is doing.
So there's like a mastery threshold. Below it, you're dangerous. Above it, you're bending.
Exactly. And the overall fatality rate is about 1.4 deaths per 100,000 flights, which is roughly twice general aviation. But here's the thing that surprises everyone. 55% of accidents happen during landing.
Landing, not that you know, being 1,000 meters in the air part.
Not the scary part. The part where you're close to the ground and you think you've got it figured out. 90% of all accidents are pilot error, not equipment failure. The wing almost never fails. It's the human reading the air wrong.
That's okay, so the airbending metaphor isn't just cute, it's structurally accurate. The skill is the safety system.
Now, let me tell you about the materials, because this progression is beautiful. You remember our alchemy episode?
Episode 122, yeah. The alchemists who were trying to make gold and accidentally invented chemistry.
Same energy here. The progression of paragliding materials is military tech being accidentally repurposed into something magical. In the 60s, they're using standard heavy nylon, barely controllable. Then in the 70s, ripstop nylon, a World War Roman II invention where they weave a grid pattern into the fabric so tears can't spread.
Ripstop, that's the stuff in like every outdoor jacket now.
Right, but here's where it gets interesting. Think of this like Wind Waker, the Zelda game where Link has this baton, the Wind Waker, and he uses it to conduct the wind. He can't see the wind, but he learns to read it, command it, shape his entire journey around it.
I love that game. The whole world is ocean and wind.
So the materials progression in paragliding is like upgrading from a basic baton to the full Wind Waker. In the 90s, a French textile company called Porcher Sport creates Skydex 40, 40 grams per square meter, polyurethane coated, UV resistant. This becomes the gold standard. It's the moment the instrument gets good enough that the conductor can actually perform.
So before Skytex, pilots were trying to conduct the wind with what, a stick?
Pretty much. But then in the 2010s, Porsche releases Skydex 27, 27 grams per square meter, almost transparent, and this changes everything because suddenly your entire wing can fit in a running backpack.
Wait, how big are these things normally?
A normal paraglider with harness is maybe 15 kilos, but with ultralight materials, you can get the whole setup under 3.5. And that enables what they call hike and fly. You literally hike up a mountain with your wing in your backpack, launch from the summit, and fly back down. No cable car needed. No infrastructure at all.
That is the most anime thing I've ever heard of in real life. You just walk up a mountain and then fly off it.
There's an entire subculture called Vol Bivouac. Multi-day trips where you hike, fly, camp, hike, fly, camp. Just traveling across mountain ranges under your own power, alternating between walking and flying.
I need to do this immediately.
And the newest material, Dynamic Composites. Strongest fiber by weight on Earth. They're pushing towards sub-20 grams per square meter. And now we're at Skydex 27, where the canopy is almost see-through. Every generation trades something. Heavier coatings give you more UV protection but more weight. Lighter fabric gives you portability but less durability. A well-maintained wing lasts 300 to 500 flight hours, and UV damage is the silent killer.
So it's all trade-offs. Weight versus durability versus protection.
Speaking of Switzerland, and I mean, when are we not talking about Switzerland at this point?
Honestly, at this rate we should just rename the show. Swisscast.
Remember the Interlaken episode? Episode 135, and the Zurich one?
Yeah, and the Room of Requirement episode, where we talked about how every culture visits Switzerland and sees a completely different country.
Paragliding is the perfect example of that. Switzerland became the sport's spiritual home in the 80s and 90s. The Alps are the ideal laboratory. Consistent thermals because of valley wind systems, dramatic elevation changes, and all the mountain infrastructure already there. Cable cars become free altitude. You ride up, you fly down.
So the ski industry accidentally subsidized paragliding.
Basically, yeah, and this is the thing. Barsch had the same idea back in 66. Used the ski resort infrastructure in summer for slope soaring. He was decades early. But when the Alps picked it up, they had everything. The thermals, the elevation, the tourists, and the Instagram-ready scenery.
And now I'm guessing it's a massive tourism industry.
Global paraglider market was 271 million in 2025, projected to hit 463 million by 2034. And places like Grindelwald, where you launch from a spot called first and you're face-to-face with the Eiger North Face. Flights last 15 to 40 minutes depending on thermals. And here's the detail I love. Pilots routinely share thermals with golden eagles up there.
I'm sorry, what?
Golden eagles use the same thermals. You're circling in this invisible column of rising air, and a golden eagle just pulls up next to you like it's the most normal thing in the world.
You're circling with an eagle, at altitude, in the Swiss Alps, because you're both reading the same invisible elevator.
Both airbenders, if you will.
That might be the most magical real-world thing we've ever covered on this show, and we've covered alchemists.
There's a really interesting tension in the sport right now, though. Modern tandem operations and beginner-friendly wings have lowered the barrier to entry massively. You can literally show up in Grindelwald as a tourist, strap in with a pilot, and be flying 20 minutes later, which is amazing for accessibility.
Bob.
But 62% of fatalities are low-experienced pilots. The sport's fatality rate has dropped 40% since 2000. Better gear, better training. Something called SIV training, where you deliberately practice wing collapses and recovery over water. That alone cut stall accidents by 40%. But the question is whether making it easier to start also makes people overconfident before they've hit that mastery threshold.
The 200-hour airbending threshold.
Right, and now with electric paramotors. There's an open source one called the OpenPPG that gives you 27 minutes of powered flight. The barrier gets even lower. You don't even need a mountain anymore.
So the future of this is you just strap a motor to your back and fly from your backyard?
Potentially. Plus AI-assisted flight. Revolt time, thermal prediction, optimal route planning, safety alerts. Smart reserve parachutes that auto-deploy based on G-force and descent rate sensors.
AI airbending assistance. We've come full circle.
I keep coming back to Barsch, though. 1965. He had the concept. He had the flight. He toured resorts pitching it. Nobody cared. 13 years later. three French guys who couldn't afford gas money do essentially the same thing and it becomes a global sport. And Barish dies in 2009 without the credit.
There's something almost cruel about that. Like the idea was right. The physics was right. The timing was just wrong.
And that's the thing about invention, right? Having the idea isn't enough. You need the idea, the technology, the community, and the moment. Barish had 2 out of 4. The French trio had all 4. Even if the community was just 3 broke friends egging each other on.
You know what? Maybe the lesson is that magic isn't about who discovered the spell first. It's about who got enough people to believe in it.
That's actually beautiful. You should write for the show.
I do write for the show.
Debatable. Alright, so next time, speaking of people strapping things to their bodies and jumping off cliffs, I want to talk about base jumping. Because if paragliding is airbending, base jumping is what happens when someone watches an airbender and goes, cool, but what if I did that with no room for error?
Oh no!
4 letters. Building, antenna, span, earth. 4 objects you can jump off. 1 parachute. 0 margin.
I already need a nap, and maybe a therapist.
That's next time on Clowncast. Thanks for hanging out, everybody. Go outside and look up at the clouds. You'll never see them the same way again.
They are thermal exhaust. I hate that, I know that now. See you next time, folks.